And I quote, "Surviving violence and war marks a person's life forever. You carry it with you wherever you go. Only the intensity changes. Sometimes it is overwhelming and sometimes it's just there waiting in a familiar touch, smell or sound that turns your peace of mind upside down in a split second. You become oversensitive and sometimes expect too much from others." A paragraph from Olivera Simic's book Surviving Peace, a political memoir. Following the war in the former Yugoslavia, she found her country changed, her language no longer spoken, and her family hopelessly divided, not only by distance but by politics too. Now, I vividly remember Marshal Tito's rule, and some of his rule, I must say, I greatly admired. I liked the way he kept giving the finger to the Soviet, but certainly ethnic divisions were suppressed and discussions of grievances which flared during World War II were not encouraged. One of the world's most ethnically and religiously diverse countries did, however, maintain the peace. But only while Tito lasted. After he died, it took 12 years for war to unravel in 1992, and that lasted until 1999 and gave us, amongst other horrors, that most appalling of euphemisms, ethnic cleansing. And today the region remains riven by ethnic tension and divisions. Dr. Simic is a human rights activist and academic. She studied and worked in Eastern and Western Europe, the USA and South America. Today she teaches international law and transitional justice at Griffith Law School in Brisbane. And having had the advantage of reading her story, I must say, I said something to her off air. I said, "Molly, you're a troublemaker, because you cannot believe how much trouble this young woman has seen." Welcome to our little wireless program, Molly.
Thank you, Philip. Thanks for inviting me.
Ollie, I visited Yugoslavia when Tito was alive. Mm. I was trying to make a feature film on the Yugoslavian conflicts which were simmering away, not only there, but really here, because there was a lot of what could well be described as terrorist activities going on in Australia. But what do you remember of Bosnia as a child?
My memories of Yugoslavia, or former Yugoslavia and Bosnia and Herzegovina, where I grew up, are very fond memories. And, you know, I usually remember my childhood, my teenage years, my friendships. My parents, we were middle class. We had a pretty nice life, if I can say, as a majority, I think, of Yugoslav people back then. So my memories of that time, just before war, are really nice and good memories. We had a free education, free health care. We could go to, you know, have holidays, go to the sea and the coast, what I did with my parents for one month yearly. We would go to the Adriatic coast and enjoy our holidays. As I said, majority of Yugoslav people back then were middle class. I remember Yugoslavia as a very progressive country. We could watch, you know, Western movies. We could listen to ABBA and Boney M and Billy Idol. So my childhood and teenage years, and I'm saying that because I know that my friends who grew up in Czechoslovakia, what was back then, they could not really
they didn't enjoy the same privileges. Now, I'm glad you've said this, because people have to understand that are listening to what we're saying. Mm. That Yugoslavia was not a grim Eastern European communist country. It was very much its own country. And yet the capital, Sarajevo, is a place where you can still find Jewish synagogues, an Ottoman mosque, Catholic and Christian Orthodox churches. Misha Glenny writes that it was through Bosnia that East met West, Islam met Christianity, the Catholic eyes, the Orthodox. Mm. And Bosnia, of course, also divided the empires of Vienna and Constantinople.
Yes. In the Balkans, because of specific geographical position, there was always, we have been, you know, Yugoslavia has been on this position between East and West and has been of interest to great powers. And that's sort of trouble. And I guess that may be a trouble in the future. That's why we have almost every 30 or 40 years a war day. Because there are a lot of interests going on in this region.
I mentioned ethnic cleansing when I was introducing you, but of course there's also linguistic engineering. Let's talk about that. Your mother tongue is Serbo-Croatian, but this was split after the war, each ethnicity to their own language. What are you now meant to speak?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Philip. Thanks for asking that. And I'm usually confused, and people ask me which language do you speak. I often pause and not sure how to answer. And that's probably the simplest question in the world. You can ask somebody which language do you speak. And I'm always minded that whatever I say, it's loaded with politics. So, you know, and it puts you in particular ethnic box, or it puts you in particular political position. So if I say Serbo-Croatian, what I say, that I speak Serbo-Croatian, that's basically language that's gone, that's dead, and that actually died when Yugoslavia was proclaimed dead in 1992. Because we started then to... we have now three official languages, and each ethnic group claim to have their own language. It's basically the essence of that. These new languages, Serbian, Croatian, and Bosnian, is the same language. It is Serbo-Croatian, but with different variations of Serbo-Croatian and with some invented new words.
How do you feel about having a Serbian identity imposed upon you?
I don't feel good. I don't think of myself as a Serb. I don't have that ethnic identity. I have very much gender identity. I think of myself as a woman, as a feminist, as a researcher, as academic. But of course, my parents are Serbs, but I don't have that ethnic identity. And I think the more people try to enforce that identity, the more I struggle and reject that identity. And that became a struggle with my father too, who really wants me to have that identity, and I back up and I don't want and I resist. So the more he pushes or people pushes it, the more I back up and I say, this is not my identity. I don't want to have that identity. I did not grow up with this identity ever. So this identity I acquired after the war. I had to acquire after the war, you know. I had to be boxed. So people, when they ask me, where are you from or which language do you speak, it's usually with this intention to put you somewhere, you know, to put you in these boxes.
This is LNL on RN, and I'm talking to Olivera Simic, author of Surviving Peace, a Political Memoir, and you will be astonished where her life takes you, or takes all of us, later in our discussion. Now, since the war, Bosnia has gone through multiple transitions. Once again, I quote from you, from war to peace, from single-party rule to pluralist democracy, from communist planned economy to liberal market economy, from international protectorate to independent country. Has it survived these transitions, Ollie?
No, I don't think so, and that's the trouble. I don't think any of these transitions have been ended, actually. They are still there, and we are still going through this transition, and I'm not really sure how long it will take that we transit from war to peace, because what usually people will now say in Bosnia, they will say that we still have a war, but with another means. So there are no shooting, there are no guns, but war is, you know, on another battlefield, and it's waging with arms and with hearts and with minds rather than...
Well, 50% of the people are still unemployed.
Yes.
Many of those who finish university are unemployed. Yes. Mind you, that's not unique, of course, to Bosnia.
Of course.
And on top of everything else, you've had disastrous floods this year, added disaster.
Yes. So, yeah, it really seems one disaster after another. And this latest floods that happened in May, I just recently been to Bosnia and actually came back 2 weeks ago. And I've met a lot of my friends who stayed without job due to floods. So on the top of 50% of unemployed people, I think we at least have 10 or 15% more, because floods just destroyed even the small businesses who employed people who then were feeding their families. So...
Let's talk about you. Now, the war in Bosnia ends in 95. The war in Kosovo continues till 1999. Mm. And when fighting broke out, your lifelong friends, Bosniaks and Croats, had to flee. You never saw them again. And your parents sent you to neighbouring Serbia, where they thought you would be safe. The separation must have been so terrible.
Yeah, it was very difficult for me back then because I was only 19 years old, and that was basically the first separation from my parents. I have never been separated before 1992 from them, and so that was the first separation. It was basically violence and forced separation because I had to go. They were basically very afraid for my life, and they decided that I need to leave the city after I was about to be drafted in some sort of civilian protection or something like that. So once when I went to pick up the boots and uniform with my father, that was for them the clear sign that it's time to leave. So basically overnight they just put me on the bus and sent me to Serbia. And I found myself in a refugee accommodation from then on.
Now, let's be clear here. You were not of an ethnic minority forced to flee, but you had to watch others fleeing. And the scenes you describe are terrible. I'm thinking particularly of the Croatian military operation called Storm. Tell us about Storm.
Yeah, thanks for asking, Philip, about that. And it's interesting you ask about Storm because it's also anniversary from the Operation Storm, which actually started on August 4 in 1995, so 19 years ago. And what's interesting about Storm is that what happened in Storm is that a quarter of millions of Serbs were expelled from Croatia in 4 days. A couple of thousands of them were killed during that Operation Storm. No one was held responsible. So initially, two generals, Ante Gotovina and Markač, Ivan Markač, were prosecuted by the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia. But then later on, their sentences and judgments were squashed and they were released. And not only that, but they have been welcomed in Croatia and the capital of Zagreb as a heroes, as a national heroes, and they are perceived as a national heroes in Croatia. In the meantime, so what is going to happen today in Bosnia or Serbia and Croatia? And that's interesting. Today, Croatian government is going to celebrate Operation Storm, or the beginning of Operation Storm, on August 4 as a day of victory and national day and day of pride, day of nationhood, while at the same time in Serbia it's going to be the day for mourning for people who had to flee their homes.
Ollie, now that you're with us in Australia, you would be aware that there's an echo of that same paradox on Australia Day, which white people see as a moment of unalloyed joy.
Yes.
But, of course, the Indigenous population don't see it through that prism at all.
Yeah. Yes, these divisions and interpretations of history, of course, are not something that is unique to Bosnia. And, of course, it's something that we see in Australia as well, between Aboriginal people and white Anglo-Saxon people each day when we mark Australian Day on January 26. These divisions and these narratives come up. The same is happening in Yugoslavia and the other countries of the world. It's not something unique. But these divisions and different narrations of the same events are something that deeply divides societies and something that we cannot come to consensus about.
Well, Ollie, let's look at the way they divided your family, because you feel a responsibility in your academic work to talk about crimes committed by your own people. And so when you go home to visit your parents, your father is very upset by what you've written, as is your brother, a former Serbian soldier.
Yes, my whole family does not approve of my research and of what I'm doing, and they are not happy with my writing. And my father, a few years ago, he told me, and I write about that, I have a chapter about that in Surviving Peace, that I have to stop writing. And I think there is a mixture of shame and embarrassment because his daughter is doing something that I shouldn't do, something that he doesn't want me to do, because I dedicated my work and my moral, because I feel moral responsibility to talk about crimes committed by my own ethnic group.
You quote Hannah Arendt, who wrote about the importance of individualized responsibility and about guilt as an individual matter. Can you talk to that?
Yes, I think moral responsibility and individual is guilt and individual responsibility is very important. If we want to change anything, we need to accept accountability and responsibility. Of course, I cannot be guilty for something that that perpetrators of the crime committed. I cannot be guilty for horrendous crimes that were committed on the part of my ethnic group or ethnic group of my parents. But there is moral responsibility, and that calls each of us to talk about crimes committed in our neighborhood, crimes committed in our name. And it's very important to individualize guilt. And I think one of the obstacles now in Bosnia is also collective guilt. If we continue to collectively blame one part and only one side for the war, we will, I think, never come to any sort of reconciliation.
Ollie, you and I agree that every government should assume political responsibility for the deeds and misdeeds of its predecessor. LNL on RM, Olivera Simic, Surviving Peace, a Political Memoir. Of course, when you visit home and locals find out what you've been up to, they see you as having been unduly influenced by Western thinking on reconciliation.
Yes, because I studied in West, I did my undergraduate studies as a refugee in Serbia during my refugee time. I often talk about this to my students. It was quite unbelievable that you can finish studies as a refugee. I mean, it's certainly unbelievable in Australia, which doesn't treat its refugees properly, to say at least. So when I was a refugee, I did my studies in law from my refugee camp. And then I went on to do my master's in England in international human rights law, and then later on in Costa Rica in gender and peace building. So I'm pretty much studied, right, in this Western context and read literature written by Western experts and scholars. And majority of them, probably 90% of them, took the sides in this war as majority of powers, international community, which sees Serbs as the perpetrators and Bosniak as the victims exclusively. So there was no really this black and white, but so probably I was influenced by what I read back then.
Yeah. Now, let's be specific here. Your father will argue with you, saying that the Srebrenica massacre is a lie, and your brother, a former soldier in the Serb forces, as we've said, has not spoken to you. I mean, you've paid a very heavy personal price, haven't you?
Yes. We don't speak about my work, so we pretend that I'm just, I don't know, teaching in Australia, but we never talk about my research, we never talk about my awards, we don't celebrate my awards. Recently I got a research award at Griffith University, and we don't talk about it because they know what is my work about and they just don't approve it. So we rather pretend it doesn't exist. And that my part of intellectual being and my engagement with war crimes in the ways that I'm doing is just something not acceptable, and it should be hidden rather than celebrated.
Okay, let's look at, I mentioned it in passing, that's the issue of reconciliation. You've worked at various international organisations, at UNICEF, for example, and between 2007 and 10, you lectured on gender and war in Sarajevo. How open were these younger students to the idea of reconciliation?
Look, Philip, I think as I said, I've just been to Bosnia and Serbia, and I actually taught intensive course in transitional justice in the Balkans in Belgrade, and I had a group of students coming from all around the world, and from Israel, from Palestine, from Kosovo, from Serbia, from Bosnia. And always in this course, it's a very challenging. We have always heated discussions, and people who have first-hand experiences with war, especially people who lost someone there, they are actually very angry if you try to, if you use buzzword reconciliation. A lot of people don't like this word because they feel that they need to reconcile, that war ended today and there was international community talking about reconciliation tomorrow and people were not ready. So now we can say, so even 20 years after war was ended, people still don't feel ready. And I was thinking for a long time that we need to wait at a generation of my father. So I was blaming generation of my father who voted for war, who were very much playing the politics back then. And I was praying my hopes in this younger generation. But now actually, when I see how the younger generation are actually or can be very poisoned by the stories of their parents, I'm not that hopeful, because some of them are very resistant and some of them are looking for revenge, and some of them just say, no, I don't want to reconcile and I will reconcile on my terms and when I feel ready, or I won't reconcile ever because I just can't forgive what happened. So,
Molly, just to go back to another aspect of the family problems. Your mother has said that there's a danger they could be killed because of what you write. You write in English, but these things have a way of getting known, and you are concerned. You do feel fear that someone could hurt your parents or brother, or at least bully and ostracize them.
Yeah, to be honest, yes, I wouldn't be honest to say, no, I don't have any fear and any doubts. I have, and I always have concern that something may happen. But I guess I have been writing about these issues for quite some time now. And so far, they haven't had any direct threats, or not at least that I know about it. But I know that they absolutely don't feel comfortable about what am I doing. So I hope that, you know, nothing will happen to them, and I hope that I'm not really putting them into risk. But I am conscious and I am aware that the work that I choose to do is not something that is light, it's not something that is approved, it's not something that's welcomed in the part of the Bosnia in which they live in. That it's pretty, if I may say, I can't say dangerous, but it's absolutely not welcomed, right?
I haven't got any time to tell you the story about the film I wanted to make in Yugoslavia and in Australia, but it did involve the most appalling conflicts between Yugoslav groups in this country, where quite a few were being trained in the Dandenong Rangers, would you believe, to go to Yugoslavia and kill Tito. You've witnessed the NATO bombing of Sarajevo, and for 78 days, during both night and day, cluster bombs, depleted uranium and munitions were dropped. It killed almost 1,000 civilians and was classified by NATO as collateral damage.
So I guess you're thinking about NATO bombing in Serbia, right?
Yes.
You mentioned Sarajevo. That's why I was just a bit confused. So, yes, and in Niš, in southern Serbia, I was there during the NATO bombing or so-called humanitarian intervention. Remember those days. I think that NATO bombing was one of the final drops in the layers of the trauma that I survived, and it actually had a very horrendous impact on my being and how.
Okay, let's focus on what you have suffered. Let's look at the PTSD. You left to work at Human Rights Watch in Washington, a terrific organization, and heavens above, you're there. And you witness another catastrophe, the attacks of 9/11, which reignited your problems.
Yes. Yes. So when I went to the U.S. in 2001, that was actually the first time. It was second time that I'm going, that I was went abroad. And I thought, as my parents, and we were all thrilled, we thought that I'm going to the U.S. It was very exciting to go to the Washington, D.C., to work with the Human Rights Watch, amazing international organization. And I was about to work as a legal fellow on trafficking in women by peacekeepers, another interesting story there, back then. But what happened just a couple of weeks into my staying in a residence in Washington, D.C. was 9/11, and I was about to go from Washington, D.C. to New York on that day. And I described these events in quite detail, some of my feelings during these couple of weeks after September 11 and my panic attacks and flashbacks. And flashbacks were actually related to the NATO bombing, 78 days of NATO bombing in Serbia, that I never had time to think about them and reflect on them. So September 11 brought up these events from 2 years ago in 1999, but also other layers of trauma that were there that I never picked up.
I understand that at this time you also had your first encounter with the rather Western notion of counseling.
Yes. So once my dear boss back then, Martina Vanderberg, she noticed that something is going on with me, and she knew my background, she knew where I'm coming from, and she had a lot of experience working with people who survived trauma, people who are coming from post-conflict societies. She tried to pursue me to have a counseling for the first time in my life. I didn't know what's counseling really back then because mental health was one of the issues we never discussed really, or we didn't discuss in former Yugoslavia. It was people who had some sort of mental disorders or illnesses are very much ostracized as they are today. So I didn't know what does that involve, and you know, she explained me that they are going to fly over this best psychotherapist from New York who is going to treat the staff in Human Rights Watch because of September 11, and she just asked me to give a try and talk to this woman, and I really didn't want, and I resisted. I said, no, I can't do this. This is just something. I don't know what to talk to this woman. I said, look, it's 2001. War started in 1992. I survived so many things so far, and I didn't know how to engage in this conversation. I had no clue how that was supposed to look like because I never had that. My counselors were my friends or my family, and we would resolve these issues, talk about traumas, and probably re-traumatize each other by telling each other stories of trauma, but we never talked to third person to talk about issues.
So you go to Costa Rica, where, let the record show, there was an earthquake. As I said to you off air, you really are a troublemaker. Mm. And it's here that things get worse and worse for you. You read about the mass rape of Muslim women. So finally, 12 years after, you have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. So, yes, that happened in 2004 while I was doing a gender and peace building master's in beautiful Costa Rica in Ciudad Colón at UN University for Peace. And that was the first time I was so distanced from Bosnia, from Yugoslavia, from war. But then I found myself in the small library at that university very closely looking at what happened in the war. So that's a paradox, you know. People would think that I am authority to talk about war in Bosnia. When I came to university, everyone was excited to have somebody, you know, live example of somebody who survived Bosnian war. But then they encountered somebody who was so confused, and as I was confused back then, and not ready to talk about war at all. And I was actually surprised that people have these expectations and they think I know everything about war, and they would ask me to talk about war, and I was absolutely not ready. And also I started to read, because I never, before that, I was not really engaged that much with the scholarly work around war, around mass atrocities, around mass rapes, around ethnic cleansing and genocide. But then at that place and time, I had all this time in the world, I had this distance, and I just started to spend hours and hours, days and nights in the library and back home reading about this and writing. That's where I started to write. But that's where I started to experience extreme flashbacks and panic attacks that I couldn't recognize at the beginning.
Then you moved to Australia in 2011, and once again, troublemaker as that you are, you're in time for the Brisbane floods.
Yes, I was here in Brisbane during the floods, which you know, I'm not going to compare the floods with my experiences, and I actually don't like to do these hierarchies of traumatic experience. I think it's very dangerous. But why floods were important for me were in the sense that they again triggered some of these past traumas, layers of my past memories, and fears and anxieties and uncertainties, and also fears and anxieties with my parents, because they also went through a lot with us as their kids, with my brother who was in war, with me who was in refugee, and then, you know, survived all these various things that were following my life. And it was very disturbing in many senses to go through these floods, but also to observe how people behave and to think about my life yet again through prism of all these events that happened to me before.
Ollie, let's try to end on a slightly optimistic note, because there's a postscript here to a possible Bosnian spring, because you saw during reports of demos this year against government corruption, unemployment, poverty, three boys joining the Serb, Croat and Bosnian flags, for example.
Yes, I end up my book with this sign of hope that another future is possible, that we still can live together, that we don't have such divisions in Bosnia anymore. And I would like to think that another future is possible, and I want to think, and that's my work is about thinking that we can somehow overcome some of these issues that divide us. And I know that there are a lot of people in former Yugoslavia, not only in Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, peace activists and civil societies that I do a lot of work with, that do really amazing and very important things that government don't do. And they are trying with their actions, with their lobbying, with their theater plays, with their street actions, with all sorts of campaigns, they try to challenge these dominant views and hatred and stereotypes about particular ethnic groups, and trying to overcome and educate especially young people, put hope in young people that another future is really possible in Bosnia.
Ollie, good to talk to you. Dr. Olivera Simic's book, Surviving the Peace, a Political Memoir, published by Spinifex Press. Thank you for your time, Ollie, and might I also add, good luck.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks a lot for inviting me. Thank you.
And that's LNL for today, and indeed for the week. Next week, we look at Team Abbott, yes, the men and women who advise the Honourable Prime Minister. And for more information about any of our programs, you can visit our website on abc.net.au/Radio National and look in programs for Late Night Live. And now to Team Adams. Good on ya. Executive producer Gail Basario, producers Murdita Dias, Stan Correy, Penny Lomax, Laura Schunner, Martin Peralta, and Mike Pritchard here in Musselbrook. That's a lot for now. Stick around on RN, and I'll talk to you next week.